We are studying Parashat Behar. Parashat Behar, one of the main topics of the Parashah is the law of Shemitah. What is the law of Shemitah? We are not so familiar with it because it's a law that only really affects the farmers of Israel. We are living in the exile in America, so we're not bound by the laws of Shemitah. But basically what it is, the Torah allows the Jewish farmer to work for 6 years. He's able to plow his land and seed the land. He's able to water his land, and he's able to reap the fruit of his land for 6 years like every farmer does. However, the Torah says in the seventh year, that's Bashana Shvi'it, he must take a rest and he must let his field rest. He's not allowed to work in the seventh year. It's like Shabbat. It means just like 6 days you work and the seventh day you rest. So it's 6 years of working the field, and in the seventh year it's a forced vacation. Now that's a very difficult law. Because imagine, it's not a field. Imagine you have a store. You have a store on Fifth Avenue, and the Torah tells you you could work your store for 6 years. And in the seventh year, you have to leave the store closed. But it's even worse than that, not closed. You have to leave the field opened for anybody to come into the field and take whatever they want. Which in Hebrew they call that hefker. It's ownerless. You put a sign up, you know, the Shemitah year, kol dechvin yeteh v'yechud. Anybody wants to come, you're able to come and eat at your own, not own risk, but at your own time frame. And that's what happened. You know how difficult it is for a man to see strangers coming into his field, taking all his tomatoes and taking all his wheat and taking all his fruit. Very difficult. Now again, if you have a store on Fifth Avenue, you don't need a year for them to clean out the store if you put a sign up like that. Obviously in a few minutes, they'll clean out everything. But the point is, the Shemitah is to remind the Jewish farmer, and for that matter, all of us, that it's not our land. The land belongs to God. And for that matter, it's to remind us as well that parnasah, what we make in the course of a year of a livelihood, is really not dependent on our efforts. A person might get a little arrogant when he starts to make money during the 60 years and he says, oh, look what I'm doing, I'm working, I'm plowing, this is my accomplishment. And the Torah comes along and says, it's not you. Parnasa is a gift from God. And even though God tells us we should work, but ultimately it's not our efforts that bring us to Parnasa, because we see two people do the same exact job and they sell the same exact item, and they have stores in the same exact locations, and one guy's making a lot of money, and one guy can't make any money. You say, but they're doing the exact same thing. So you see that it's not the industriousness necessarily that brings the parnasah, it's the beracha from Borei Olam. If God wants a person to make money, he can make money. And if he doesn't, no matter what he does, he's not going to. That's why the Gemara says, when choosing a profession, what should you do? What should be the process of making the decision of what job you should go into? So the Gemara says, Nikiya vekala. You should choose a profession that's clean. Clean meaning from robbery, from thievery, which is an honest business. And kala, easy, which means people think that they have to go into a certain industry, and only in that given industry will they be able to make money. Because they look at the statistics. Most people that go into this industry are rich. And most people that go in this industry are not rich. And therefore, they'll work 7 days a week or 6 days a week, seven nights a week, thinking that this is where their parnasah can come from. The Gemara says, don't get fooled by that. Nikiya vekala. And then put the rest in God's hands. And God decides. And some people are able to take a job that they at least enjoy doing. And then they open up what's called a faucet. Now wants to have a faucet so God can send the parnasah down that faucet. The biggest proof was the year of Shemitah. Here they didn't work for an entire year. And it says nobody ever starved and nobody ever died because they followed the Shemitah year. As a matter of fact, the Torah tells us that they were blessed threefold. If I quote you the Pasuk says, God says, V'siviti et birchati bashana ashelishit, or bashana ashishit, I will give my blessing in the sixth year, ve'asa et ha-tevu'ah le'shalosh shanim. You're going to make 3 years of wheat in the sixth year. I'll explain to you what that means. A person is taking off for the seventh year. So let's say he makes $100,000 a year. So he's losing the $100,000 of the seventh year. He's also losing the $100,000 of the eighth year. How? Because in the eighth year, he has to plant. He didn't start doing anything. So it takes him a year just to get his business back. He's a farmer. If he didn't plant in the seventh, there's nothing in the eighth either until the end of the eighth. So he loses $100,000 of the seventh. He loses $100,000 of the eighth. Now in the sixth year, he's working. So the Torah tells us, God's going to give him the beracha. In the sixth year, he's going to make for 3 years. Now that simply means, so if he normally makes 100 that year, he'll make 300. So he'll be able to live for the sixth, for the seventh, and for the eighth. But our rabbis have a problem with this explanation. Because we know that there's what's called free will. Every mitzvah, there's a Yetzirah Tov, and there's a Yetzirah Ra, Yetzirah Tov telling you to do it, Yetzirah telling you you're crazy, what do you think, how are you going to make it? If everybody would make triple the amount of money in the sixth year, what's the challenge to keep Shemitah? I mean, I would love that. If every sixth year I would triple my salary with open arms, I would take a vacation. The Torah is giving you a paid vacation. You have to be a fool not to do the Shemitah. You're getting 300,000, so you're going to live comfortably for 3 years. Go sleep for 3 years. Go relax. Go rest. What's the test? So the rabbis say, no, it's much more complicated than that. You're not making 300,000. You're going to be making the exact same amount that you make every year. But the chidush is, it'll last for 3 years. What do I mean? Money is very, very flexible. Sometimes money stretches, and sometimes it goes very quickly. You know that, I'm sure, better than I know that. Sometimes a person can have money in his pocketbook, and they're able to buy a lot. And there's a beracha, they don't know why. They only have a certain amount of money, but they got value out of it. Other times, you say, where'd all the money go? I didn't get anything. There's no value. It all depends, not the quantity of money that you have, but Borei Olam sometimes can put quality in the money. I'll give you an example. Somebody goes to the pizza store, orders one slice. His friend orders three slices. The person eats one slice, it costs him $1. Oh, he's full. Oh, I can't even have dinner tonight. The other guy had three slices. He's full, he's still hungry. He says, I'm satisfied. So therefore, what happened? $1 was able to satisfy the first fellow, and this guy spent $3, and he's still not satisfied. What's the difference? This has beracha, and this is no beracha, which means if there's beracha in your money, then even a little is able to go a lot. If you drive a car, you know, sometimes you're in the gas station every week. And you can't imagine, I just filled up my car with gas. How come I'm filling up again? And then there's other times where you're driving just as much, and you say, I don't know, I don't have to fill my car for a long time. What happened over here? You can't explain it. You drove the same amount, you were doing, yeah, but sometimes you have to, it's beracha. Which means, if God gives you a beracha in your money, it can stretch and go a long way. So what happens to the farmer? Comes to 6 years, makes 100,000. Now he's shaking. He says, Shema Yisrael, this 100,000 has to last me for the sixth, for the seventh, for the eighth. Now he starts to shake. How can I keep this from Itavi? I'm losing a lot of quantitative money. The Torah says, don't get scared. That if you have bitachon and a kadosh baruch hu, when you have pure faith, the little will multiply to become a lot. And from here you see another answer to a question that our rabbis asked. Our parasha starts off, Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe behar Sinai lemor. The Torah tells us that this law of Shemitah was given on Mount Sinai, on Har Sinai. Right away the rabbis ask, every law was given on Har Sinai. all the 613 mitzvot. Why does the Torah go out of its way to tell us Shemitah was given on Mount Sinai? Every law is given on Mount Sinai. So you know what the rabbis answer? The rabbis answer beautifully. This is the Ben Ish Chai says. What do we learn from Har Sinai? It was the smallest mountain. There was much more taller mountains, majestic mountains. They were bigger, more beautiful mountains to give the Torah on. And God passed over all those tall mountains and decided to give the Torah on a small hill called Har Sinai. What's the lesson of Har Sinai? Ben Ish Chai says, sometimes less is more. And that's the exact Musar of the law of Shemitah. Sometimes less is more. They're telling the farmer, learn from Har Sinai, which is if you had to make a bet, looking at all the beautiful mountains of Israel, and they told you, which mountain you think God's going to give the Torah on? You would have said, oh, maybe Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon, beautiful ski mountain. They go all the way to the peak of it, and they come skiing down. It's beautiful. Or maybe you'd say, Mount Carmel. If you ever went to Haifa, beautiful, tall, what scenery in the background. Oh, this is the mountain for Matan Torah. The last mountain you would have picked, Har Sinai, what is it? It's a small, like I said, a small little hill. But what do you see sometimes? In God's world, sometimes less is more. He chose Har Sinai for the Torah. And that's the same thing when it comes to Shemitah. Sometimes making less money, just because quantitatively it's less, but sometimes less is more. And it can last for a much longer period of time. But that, of course, takes an amount of bitachon, an amount of faith. I saw one of the rabbis bring down, rightfully so, which is harder? I guess it's not such an easy question. But which is harder, do you think? If a person has to sacrifice their life, for example, they come along and say, bow to the idols. Our religion says, we must give our life and be willing to die before we're coerced to bow to Avodah Zarah. I agree, it's not an easy thing to give up your life. But I ask you, which is harder? To give up your life or to fulfill the mitzvot of Shemitah? You would say, what do you mean, Rabbi? Shemitah, you're living at least. But think again. Somebody can argue and say, that decision that you make to give up your life, it's a 1 second decision. You give up your life, it's over. You go to Olam Abba. It's a 1 second decision. You have to have courage and strength and fortitude for one moment to say, I'm doing it for God. Great thing, don't get me wrong. In Hebrew they call that Mesirut Nefesh. Self-sacrifice for God is the most noble thing. But to fulfill the law of Shemitah, you have to go for 3 years like that, sacrificing. You know, to make a 1 second decision and then next it passes, it's easier. But to live a life of sacrifice, where every moment you have to sacrifice and do the Havdil. I'll give you another example. It's much easier to go visit somebody in the hospital than having to tend to somebody that's sick 24 hours a day. If a person has a child that's not well, Rahman al-Silam, so that is a life of Mesirut Nefesh. So that you cannot compare that person's test where it's every moment, every second, 3 o'clock in the morning, 365 days a year, all the different problems and the bringing and the going, to somebody that goes to visit somebody in the hospital from time to time. Yes, it is sacrifice to take from your schedule to go make a Bikur Olim visit, but somebody that's living a life of sacrifice, that's much harder. And therefore, our Torah says it's much more difficult to live for God than it is to die for God. To die for God, it's a one moment decision. But to live for God, that's the greatest challenge. God doesn't want us to die. God wants us to live. That's why the Hakamim tell us those that keep the Shemitah are compared to angels. They're compared to Malachim. Because they need to have that strength of character and to that fortitude of nature to subdue their temptations for 1 year, not to work, and to have full trust in Borei Olam. And I want to point out, the law of Shemitah was not only given to the great rabbis. The law of Shemitah is assigned to all people. What does that tell you about the confidence that God has about us. God is commanding all the Jewish people, you all have the ability to be like angels. God doesn't say, only the rabbis in the kollel, only the guys in the yeshivot, only the people that are devout, they have to keep Shemitah. Nah. Shemitah must be kept by everybody. What a vote of confidence God is giving us. God is telling us, you could be an angel. You could do it. You'll be able to subdue that nature to want to make money and to want to go work. It's in your capability. Many times, as Jews, we say to ourselves, it's too difficult. It's too hard. But if you'd only know what Borei Olam, what God thinks of us, and what God thinks of our capability, there is nothing that is beyond our potential. The Rambam clearly writes, every single Jew has the capacity to become as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu? We would never make such a bold statement. We would say we can become great, you know, as a religious, maybe extra religious, a little better, a little less. But Rambam, he told us our true capacity. Moshe Rabbeinu, anything less, we didn't fulfill our potential. So therefore, whenever it comes to a mitzvah, ladies, you're always supposed to say to yourself, I can do it. God would not give us a mitzvah if we didn't have the ability to fulfill the mitzvah. You have to remember that. That's why Abraham was tested to sacrifice his son, and we weren't. Because God knows we would not be able to pass such a test. For us, that's beyond our limitation. But for Abraham Avinu, it was doable. And because it was doable, he succeeded. And Abraham Avinu took a shot at it. And that's why you have to know the 613 mitzvot are equal opportunity. It's not only for the people living in Bnei Berak, or living in Williamsburg, or Me'a Sha'arim, or, you know, living in some isolated community somewhere in Muncie, or another area in the world. The Torah was given to every single Jew, whether they're living in Las Vegas, or whether they're living in New York, or Beverly Hills. The Torah has application to everybody, and everybody has the capability to succeed at it. Of course, if they have the will to succeed. But I'm telling you from the Perashah, if God commanded everybody to do Shemitah, that means He trusts us that we could have the bitachon and faith even of angels. There's a famous community in Israel that's called Komumiyut. I think I told you a story last year about this community. It's a farming community, Komemiyut, and they are known for keeping the laws of Shemitah in the most stringent way. There are many farm communities in Israel that till today keep the laws of Shemitah. They must be applauded. It's an amazing thing. Strength of character, watching their business just grow fallow for 1 year. Tremendous amount of bitahon. But Komemiyut is known to not only follow Shemitah, but to follow it with all the chumrot of the Chazon Ish and all the great rabbis. As a matter of fact, in 1954, there was a question that they had. The Shemitah was over. This was the 8th year. And now they needed seeds to plant. And there were no seeds available. All the seeds of wheat that were available were from Shemitah year. And you're not allowed to use the Shemitah seeds to plant. So there were no seeds around. The only seeds available for them in the 8th year was some wormy seeds that were inferior, that were from the 6th year. All the agriculturists told them, don't invest in this. You're going to plant, you're not going to have a good crop. You're wasting your money. They went to the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish said, no, you can't use the seeds from the 7th year. Use the seeds that have the worms in them and use the inferior seeds. They listened to the Chazon Ish, they planted them. But then they came back to the Chazon Ish. They said, listen, Hakam, already we're using these seeds that are not good. Even though you're not allowed to work on Chol HaMoed, specifically farming work is very difficult work, it's laborious work. On Chol HaMoed, you're not allowed to do farming. They said, Hakam, if we don't plow our land during the Chol HaMoed Sukkot, we don't have a shot. The rain is going to come right after Sukkot. Our lands are not going to be plowed. So without the plowing, with the bad seeds, we don't stand a shot. Chazon Ish said, who said if you're not going to plow on Chol HaMoed, you're going to miss the rainy season? Who told you that? I don't know, we just assumed it. It's been like that for the past 1,000 years. Ali says, don't worry. Sure enough, they followed the Chazon Ish's opinion. Everybody else in all the other places in Israel, they planted 8th year, and they plowed on Chol HaMoed Sukkot. But to everybody's shock, it didn't rain in Israel that year until Chanukah. Everybody who planted early and plowed early, the seeds spoiled in the ground. And the only fields that had rain in the right time, and the seeds that grew, were from the kibbutz of Komimiyut. To show you that when you follow the laws of Shemitah, and when you listen to the advice of the Hakamim, and when you listen to the advice of the Torah, you can't lose. When one follows the law, it's automatic that there's going to be a beracha. How could it be that somebody's going to go against God's will and think he's going to be successful? And even if a person is successful, it's only temporarily. History has proven that anybody that has made a livelihood in a deceiving way, through deception, through trickery, through stealing, through robbery, through underhandedness, yes, they might have been successful for a few years. They might have had some good days. But eventually, the sheker catches up with them and all these people ended up on the bottom. And the same thing when it comes to Shemitah. Those that kept the laws and still keep the laws till today, they never got hurt by the halakha. On the contrary, miracles happened to these people. Furthermore, our Torah tells us in the beginning of the parasha, the law of the slave, the Jewish slave. The Jewish slave is bought by his master, and he works for 6 years. That's his term. After 6 years, you must let him go. However, the slave has an option to extend his contract. If the slave says, listen, I'm happy here, I like my employer, I like the work conditions, I'd like to stay for a longer period of time. The Torah says he can stay until what's called the Yovel. What is the Yovel? The Yovel is the 50th year of the Shemitah cycle. I'll explain that to you. Every 7 years is a Shemitah. So 7 Shemitot is 49 years. The 50th year is called the Jubilee year. It's called Yovel. What's so special about the 50th year of the cycle? All Jewish slaves must go free. They blow the shofar actually on Yom Kippur of that year. They don't blow the shofar every year on Kippur in the olden days. In the olden days, they would only blow the shofar on Kippur once every 50 years. And they would blow it outside the synagogue. So everybody can hear it. In every synagogue, they would blow the shofar at the same time. And that was like a bell. Everybody knew, you must let your slaves go free. Ukratem deror ba'aris. And you will call freedom in the land. That was the day of emancipation of the slaves. Our prophet Yirmiyahu, in his time, admonished the Jewish people because they weren't freeing their slaves. It was very difficult for the Jew to leave, let his worker go. And he rebuked them and said, if you don't follow this halakha, God is going to evict us from the land. God is going to throw us out of Eretz Yisrael. It's a very important law. And he finally got the Jewish people to acquiesce. And all the Jews let their slaves go. They were late, but they let them go. And then after the prophet went back, the Jewish people reneged. And they went back and they took back their slaves. And they hired them again against the halakha. And what ended up happening? God punished the Jewish people in the times of Yirmiyahu. And they were exiled from the country. So we see it's not an easy law to follow. As a matter of fact, when was this law given to us the first time in the Torah? The Yerushalmi says right when we came out of Egypt. The moment we came out of Egypt, God told us the law of freeing slaves. Why did God tell us that law of freeing slaves precisely at that moment? Because he knew at that moment we'll have a feeling to the law. We were just slaves ourselves. So when God's going to tell us, listen, you have to let the slaves go, at that moment, you know what we're going to say to ourselves? He's right. Oh, we know what it means to be a slave. You can't hold a slave forever. Look, we were slaves for 210 years. God figured the timing of the law will make them accept it more obediently. because the timing of it was right when they were slaves themselves. Furthermore, the Sefer HaChinuch says, why do we do it on Kippur? Why is Kippur the day? So he says, because that's the day of spirituality. Nobody wants to do the wrong thing on Kippur. If a person's religious one day a year, it's on Kippur. So therefore, we want to let him do the right thing on Kippur to free his slaves, so they pick that day to make it easier for him. Why does the shofar have to be blown? Says the Sefer HaChinuch, because it's not easy to let a person's slave go. But once he knows that he's not alone, once he knows his friend has to let his slave go, and his neighbor has to let his slave go, and misery loves company. When a person knows that everybody's doing it, so that peer pressure makes it a little more palatable for him. What do you see from this, ladies? You see from this, like, tremendous musar. 2 points. It's not easy to let your slaves go. You know why? Because people have a difficult, or a desire, I should say, to control. Listen to what I'm telling you. The nature of people, they want to control. And therefore, when a person has a slave, he's fulfilling that passion. He's controlling somebody. And therefore, to let that person go, he's giving in. And let me tell you the second lesson. It's not so easy to yield control once you have it. And therefore the Torah has to go. You have a prophet warning us. On Kippur Day. With the shofar, with everybody hearing it. And with all the background music. And still, the Jewish people had a difficult time letting their slaves go. Because once you have control over somebody, it's very hard to give up that power. What's the lesson to us? We don't have slaves today like they had in the olden days. Our maids are not considered Jewish slaves. But we all suffer to a certain extent with this yetzer hara to want to control people. There are some people that are controlling to their children. It's a sickness, which means they suffer themselves from inner weaknesses, of inferiority complexes. They suffer from low self-esteem, and therefore it gives them a sense of false power. What, is it powerful to dominate over a child? It's a sickness. But they feel hashuv, they feel important. This covers up their own weaknesses. Sometimes in marriages, there's a tendency of spouses to control. In our religion, in friends, there are controlling people that have to dominate and control everything and make all the decisions. And the Torah does not allow us to wield our power on anybody. We are servants of Borei Olam. God is in control of the whole world, and He does not allow us to enforce our control on anybody else. Our Torah tells us we have to love our children, we have to love our spouses. We're not tyrants in our home, nor dictators, nor despots, where we go around, it's my way, and if you don't, it's a yetzer hara. And therefore, the Torah is dealing with such a sensitive issue. I always find it fascinating. Look how progressive our Torah is. Today, if you go to therapists, one of the major issues that they deal with are control issues. Of people that don't know how to just get along with people as equals. They have to put themselves on top, and they have to domineer, etc. And look at the Torah is telling us 5,000 years ago about this yetzer hara. People are going to have a difficult time letting their slaves go. Why? Because you can tell your slave what to do. Go there, take this out, don't answer me back. So you feel good. For us, 50 years, let him go. Can I let him go? It's difficult. Kippur, let him go. I still can't let him go. But the whole world's letting their slaves go. Yeah, but it's difficult. So here you see what a big yetzer hara it is. And how important. You know, if a person kills somebody, God forbid, God doesn't exile them from the land. A person doesn't let his slave go free, God exiles the Jewish people from the land. What does that tell you? How much God despises control freaks. God will throw the Jewish people out of their land. Why? Because he didn't let the guy go free. Hazit, he's working for 6 years, he's working for 50. Let the guy go. No, you want to control the guy. I want to keep the guy. I want to hold him. God says, I throw you out of the land. What's the measure for measure? You think you're in control? You're not in control of anything. I'm in control of the world. You're not going to do anything. You're not going to have a land. You're not going to have a slave. You're not going to have a house. That's the punishment of those people that think that they're in charge. Our Torah continues. I saw a chidush. If you'll allow me to backtrack, as I'm looking at my notes, there was a great rabbi called Rav Chida. Rav Chida was a rabbi called Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai. He was one of the greatest Sephardi rabbis of the last 400 years. He lived in Italy, in Livorno. He was a rabbi that wrote over 100 Sefarim. And all his books are masterpieces. Classic work. And I want you to know, in Jewish law, the opinion of Rav Chida is the opinion that Sephardim usually follow. Now, there's three rabbis that the Sephardim usually take as their law. Rav Chida is one of them. This was a man, he used to learn every morning with a study partner. And he had a shamosh. One day the shamosh came in to give him his coffee. So he brought two cups of coffee. One for him, one for his study partner. The next day, the shamosh brings four cups of coffee. So he says, "Well, only two people. What do you mean? What are you bringing me four cups?" So the shamosh of the chida says, "What about those two?" He says, "Those two? Those are angels. They don't drink coffee." Even the servant of the chida saw angels. And the chida learned with Madachim. This is the type of great man that he was. I'll tell you the chidush that he says in the parashat, and then I'll tell you another story about Rav Chida, which I read just this week. It's good to know the stories of the Gedolim. It's good to know the stories of our rabbis. One of the greatest ways to instill fear of God in your children, is, as Jewish mothers that you are, is to sit down with your children and tell them stories about the great Hachamim. Give them a love of the Hachamim and a love of the Torah. A lot of the books that our children are exposed to sometimes send the worst messages, and they seem so innocent. When we were young, there was a story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Sounds like a very very innocent story, but if you think about what the lessons that that story teaches us, that there's a girl that went into a house and she stole somebody else's porridge. She went to eat the first one, it was too hot for her. And then she went to eat the other one, it was too cold. She saw the other one, she ate the whole thing up. She says, "She's a thief." And then she sat on the chair. This one was too big, this one was too small, this one was right, then she broke the chair. So she stole the porridge, she broke a chair, she vandalized the house, and then she left. And then the three bears came over, and they got... So you're reading a story to your children, what are you teaching them? Thievery! So you don't realize that you're reading it, how nice. Meanwhile, the children are smarter than we are. They're what's going on over here? You can go into somebody's house. And what are you teaching your children? Then you wonder the next day, when you give them their farina to eat in the morning, what do they tell you? It's too hot. What do you mean? What did you learn? It's too hot. I'm giving you this. Oh, Goldilocks said it's too hot. Now already you're teaching them. If it's not the exact way that you like it, you complain. Is this a lesson you want to teach your children to be spoiled? That unless it's just right, this is not for you? And then what's even the name Goldilocks? Where'd they get the name from? Because her curls were gold. So what are you teaching your children? External is important. The color of a person's hair and the locks, that's how we define them, by the external looks. This is what we want our children to think, that a person is defined by the locks that they have in their hair. Shema Yisrael, one simple story, Sikira, Sirifa, Avodah Zarah, Gilu Arayot, Shefichut Damim, and we're reading the kids before they go to sleep. So you have to be, if we want our children to have Yirat Shamayim, you can only read them the stories of Hazal. There's so many books of the Navi. I once walked into a room when my wife was reading the children, the Lion King. I don't know if you ever read that book, but I myself was crying when I was listening to this story over here. You're reading about the most violent story. You're reading about a story where, God forbid, a father died, orphans, violence. I said, what kind of book is this? What type of lessons? To scare children before they go to sleep so they can have nightmares? Our children are innocent. And if you think of every cartoon that they have, our children are watching, it's all violence. What do the Goyim know? Their language is violence. That's all the language that they know. So they can't show you violence explicitly because it's for children. So they put a cat running after a mouse, shooting, guns. So it looks pov, it looks innocent, but it's all violent. It's all destruction. Does this bring Yirat Shamayim to our children? Of course not. This undermines all the education that we're trying to give them. If we want our children to have fear of God, we must sit down and tell them a story about Shmuel HaNavi and his beautiful stories about David HaMelech, about King Solomon. There's so much stories that our religion has. You can stay from here for the next 100 years and they're more interesting than any. And the children get such a love and such an admiration and a such aspiration to what they can grow up to be. And they have such an awe and a fear and a love eventually of the Torah and of the Chazal. This is the type of education that Jewish mothers are supposed to bring into their homes. Instead of corrupting them with these type of books that until I mentioned it to you, you never thought twice. So what's the matter with it? It's a nice book. And look at the detrimental values. I'll tell you the story of Rav Chida that I read this week to show you the caliber of our Chachamim. He was buried in Italy. In 1960, in Rome, they turned the cemetery where the Chida was buried into a playground, into a park. And the Chida's grave was going to be desecrated as a result of it. So the chief rabbi of Israel at the time, his name was Rabbi Nissim, he was influential talking to the Roman government, and they allowed him to take the grave of Rav Chida from Rome and rebury it in Eretz Yisrael. Today, if you go to Israel, to the cemetery Har HaMenuchot, right when you walk in straight ahead, you'll see a big building, and on it, it says Yad HaChida. In 1960, they made a big funeral in Jerusalem. Thousands of people came to the reinterment of Rav Chida, when it was a big zechut to be at such a thing as a great rabbi. But this is the part of the story that I never knew. A few rabbis went to the airport when the plane arrived to receive the body of Rav Chida. It was told to them that on the plane, it seems the coffin had moved, or was shaken, or had fallen. So the question now amongst the rabbis was, should they open the coffin to at least straighten his body? The law is that a person is supposed to be buried in a certain position, and it affects it. And therefore, based on the fact that it moved, so the rabbis were concerned they should put the body at least in its proper position. Other rabbis said, no, you're not allowed to open it. It's been closed for 400 years. You can't just open up a coffin, especially if a great tzaddik like this. So there was a debate back and forth what to do. One of the rabbis that were there was Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu, who was the former chief rabbi of Israel. He impressed upon his colleagues that they have no choice but they have to do it. So with great fear and great trepidation, he opened the coffin just enough to stick his hand in, just in order to feel, just to make sure everything is in the right position. Before he put his hand actually to touch Rav Chida, he started to pray, please Rav Chida, forgive me for what I'm going to do. I'm Neshem Shamayim, I'm only coming to do it because it's the kavod of yourself to put you in the right place. Forgive me if I'm doing anything any out of order. And then he said, I pray to God, and please, Rav Chida, if you can hear me, please do it yourself so we don't have to do this. And all of a sudden, the whole coffin of Rav Chida started to shake on the table. And the bones started to clank back and forth in the kever. The rabbis that were there fainted, and the rabbi knew that he was watching a miracle in front of his own eyes, and he just kept his hand there. And after everything stopped, he made sure that everything was intact, and he closed the coffin. This is the miraculous miracles that happened not 2,000 years ago, 1960s, about 35 years ago. Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu is still alive today. He came to visit us a couple of months ago in the community. You can ask him the story. He was there, witness. He saw the Gorbin shake, the Rav Chida's bones straighten out before they interred him. These are the hachamim that we say, even after they pass away, they still have power. They're even more influential than when they were alive. Imagine that. You can go visit such a kevin and pray by such a kevin that he should go to God and be a meritz yosher. This is Yirat Shamayim. This is, do you see the impact that Gedolei Yisrael had and still have? So the Chida said in his commentary, the Chidush is not as good as the story, obviously, but the Chidush he said was, why is the Shemitah for 1 year? Why 1 year? Why not 6 months? Why not 2 months? Where do they get a year from? So he bases it on a Gemara in Berachot, page 35. The Gemara says the custom in the olden days was the men used to work 10 months, they used to learn 10 months a year, and they used to work 2 months a year. They used to work in the month of Nisan and the month of Tishri. So the Gemara says, the rabbi would tell his students, in the month of Nisan and the month of Tishri, don't come to the yeshiva. Go, do, make your money. They would plow, they would plant, whatever they were doing, it took them 2 months. So the Chida says, make a calculation. In 6 years of this schedule, every year they're working for 2 months. So that's 1 year. 6 years times 2 months. So they have to make up that 1 year of missed learning during the year of Shemitah. For the 2 months that they took off to make a living for. You have a right to make a living for 2 months, but you got to pay it back. What do you mean? You can't just steal 2 months every year without making it back. So God says, fine. Take 1 year to make up the 2 months of the previous 6 years. From here you learn exactly there's no such thing as taking time from God and not repaying it. The Torah tells us you borrow time from God, you must give it back. And therefore, if a person has, for example, an excuse that they couldn't come to a class, for example, they have a legal exemption. Certain things sometimes does not work out. But that's God's time. And therefore, you have to put it on in the book. I owe 1 hour. I owe 2 hours. The person, the Gemara says, if he has a class every morning for 1 hour, and he cannot make the class, one rabbi says of Yosef, Yazifu para, he would borrow from the day and pay back at night. Which means he didn't say, oh, I missed the class today. Tomorrow's another day. What do you mean? Tomorrow's another day. You owe God 1 hour. You can't just walk away. He's a creditor. So he would make sure at night, he would pay back that hour from the day. And that's why in the laws of Shemitah also teach us, not only is the land not ours, but our time is not ours. And therefore we're not free to do whatever we want with our time. Our time is a gift from God, and therefore we must use it wisely. And even if we're obligated to do our personal needs, we must make up that time that we invested in ourselves and give it back to Borei Olam. You ladies that come from week to week, you are paying God back for all the goodness that He's given to you and all the berachah that He's given to you. This is your way to reciprocate. Where you come back and say, this hour, this 45 minutes, and I know for most of you this is not the only class that you attend. This is maybe the lightest class that you attend. But you attend more serious classes and halakha and all the other things that they're teaching you. This is to your credit. And you are like those great Jewish farmers that are not sacrificing your lives for God, in actual, chas v'shalom, in dying for God, but you're living for God. And to live for God, as I told you, that's much more difficult. Every week the class, every week another test, every day another nisayon. That is the angelic Jew that the Rambam talked about that has the potential to become